Well, a massive cheer here in the Royal Albert Hall for our two soloists, our conductor and our orchestra. And Malcolm Arnold's Concerto for Two Pianos, Three Hands. A very typical Malcolm Arnold piece, veering from gentleness to excitement in the space of a few seconds, and always with that underlying wit there. And some delicate playing, as well as robustious playing at times, from Catherine Stott and Norika Ogawa. We've been presented with bouquets of flowers, and are now leaving the stage, as is Barry Wordsworth, but I don't think they'll be allowed to go as easily as that.
Very difficult to listen to Malcolm Arnold's music without a big smile on the face.
It's true. He lulls you into this very serious moment, and then he can't keep it up for long, it seems. He's got to bring you back down with a smile on your face and a laugh, almost.
And such vitality, such energy, and just the range, you know, 120 film scores, I think, a whole series of symphonies, so much music for special occasion. Lots of people say Malcolm Arnold's been neglected at the proms in recent years, but he's back tonight.
And deservedly so. A bow for Catherine Stott and Norika Ogawa. Barry Wordsworth invites the members of the orchestra to stand and take their applause too. Busy Albert Hall tonight. Only one or two seats vacant. An enthusiastic audience here who are enjoying every moment of it. And much more to enjoy in part two.
Absolutely. More Malcolm Arnold ahead. His English dances. More music with a royal connection as well. Not one, but three Elizabeths to celebrate in part two. And notebooks at the ready as we charge at breakneck speed through just about every radio signature tune of the 50s, 60s and 70s.
Even further back, I think, some of them, the 30s and 40s in some cases as well. Which, even further than I can go back, Petrov, I have to say. Norika Ogawa and Catherine Stott returning to the stage to receive the plaudits of the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall once again. Big smiles on their faces, and rightly so, because they played beautifully, and the audience here are only too keen to show their appreciation.
I was just thinking of the tragedy that Cyril Smith must have thought had overtaken his life when he lost the use of his left arm, but how amazing that that career continued and in such style and prompted people like Malcolm Arnold to write such sparkling works.
A beautiful piece written specifically for that couple who were such good musicians.
Well, Radio 2 and Radio 3, Ken Bruce and Petrop Trelawney live together this Wednesday night at the Royal Albert Hall, home of the BBC Proms throughout this summer. During the interval, Proms Plus, our pre-concert event, which took place a little earlier today, across the way at the Royal College of Music. It's presented by Matthew Sweet.
Yes, better check this is working first. Hello, campers. Heidi, hi. For years, light music has been banished to the darkness of lifts, the darkness of pages from CFAX, the darkness of your call is very important to us. Tonight, at the Albert Hall, a little bit of that darkness has been dispelled. Now we're going to explore what that gloom obscured, a form of music that once surged from the wireless, from palm courts and bandstands, from the tannoy system at Butlins. Here in the Hawaiian Ballroom at the Royal College of Music, we're joined by two men with an ear for post-war culture. Are they former Ovaltinis? No. Did they ever support Dorothy Squires in summer season? No, I'm not going to claim that. But they are two of our most thoughtful and literate journalists. Simon Heffer, columnist, cultural historian, Essex boy, and Andrew O'Hagan, novelist, UNICEF ambassador, and essayist. And both deserving, I think, of the kind of applause with which you might greet Semprini or the Simon Parks Orchestra. So let's hear it. Now, perhaps we could begin by doing something dangerous and daring, Simon. What is light music? Is there a way of describing it, defining it?
Well, I've always thought it was a particularly British thing. I mean, I believe there is foreign light music, but let's not confuse the issue with that now. I think it started around the time of the Great War, along really with the invention of the gramophone and the coming of the wireless. And it had its heyday right the way through until, I suppose, about 1960, when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were invented. And it was a lighter, diluted form, but by and large, of classical music. And it was often written by people who had been trained as classical musicians, many who came through this college, indeed, who became very distinguished composers of light music. And it was short in duration, and it was melodic. It had tunes, and it was of instant appeal without being cheap or trivial.
So is there something that we can hear that defines light music, Andrew? Or is it something that arises from the context, or you know, where you hear it?
I think we can hear it right away. I mean, what we hear is a sort of optimism, a sort of uplift. I mean, it's almost gone out of fashion, the notion that music could be uplifting, that tunefulness could be a real addition to your day. But I think it was a cornerstone of British light music, and certainly of the light programme, as it was called at the time. The uplift, people coming in from their work with a need for a certain kind of optimistic, nostalgic tunefulness was a real bonus. And I think that that's how it seems to me. You know, it's a form of music that actually is ingrained, if you like. It's part of the DNA of Britishness now, that you hear that music, and it's so much of it has been used as signature theme music, has been used as part of advertising. And really, whenever you want to sum up what it's like to be British, you wouldn't immediately reach for Vaughan Williams or Elgar in the popular imagination. You'd reach for British light music.
But you described it as dilute, Simon. Is it something that gives you a first taste of something before you can enjoy the stronger stuff? Is it something that you graduate from?
Well, I think in some cases it was. And I mean, Andrew's right to talk about people coming in the evening and turning on the light programme. And the BBC, the existence of the BBC after 1922 and the explosion in light music are not coincidental. One really followed the other. The BBC was one of the great patrons of light music in the period just before and just after the war. And I think many people saw it as an end in itself. But yes, I think for a lot of people, it was a way into classical music, particularly for children. I mean, we're all of a certain age. I remember growing up in the 1960s and hearing theme tunes written by people like Eric Coates and Haydn Wood, who were very distinguished composers in their own right. And it gave you certainly an interest in tunefulness. And it was, of course, it was of short duration. If you're a young person with a limited attention span, it's a very good way of getting into reasonably serious music. And yes, of course, if you're that way inclined, you will move on to something else.
Andrew, is it music with something taken out there? I mean, is it to music what the Reader's Digest is to the novel?
Well, it's often, I suppose, it would be possible to think of it anyway as British music with the pomposity taken out. And given that there is quite a lot of pomposity, not only in British music, but in music generally, it's actually light without necessarily being lightweight. I think it bears the same relation to perhaps a good piece of writing as picture postcards do. If you're interested in picture postcards and in a certain view of British life, as you mentioned at the beginning, Palm Court orchestras, End of the Pier, a certain kind of cheapness too, because of course cheap music's a bit like cheap perfume. It can be acrid, but it can be quite sexy as well. And I like that about light music, that it actually gives out to a good time. The idea is that people went out on a Saturday night and really sort of, you know, responded to this music.
Okay, well, let's listen to a piece that seems to fall very safely within the category of light music. I'm sure many of you will know this. This is by Eric Coates, and it's called Calling All Workers. Well, I think this is a useful place to start talking about what this kind of music is for, really. I mean, you know, I wonder whether this is a kind of music that speaks to a particular historical moment where a sort of collectivism was very valued.
It's motivational music. It's about women predominantly in the Second World War in factories while the men are away trying to kill Nazis, in factories building aircraft, building munitions, and it's about being cheerful. It's that sort of atmosphere that's captured in films like Millions Like Us, about to use a horrible phrase, we are all in it together. And it's music as a unifying sentiment, it's music as a unifying force. And for that reason, it shouldn't be underestimated. And it's when you hear that music, even if you weren't alive in 1942, you know that you're back in 1942, and you know that you're part of that very noble collective effort to save this country.
And yet its appeal outlasted the war, didn't it, Andrew? I mean, this music could have been heard on the radio until the 60s.
It did, because I think one of the clichés often expressed about British light music is that it's nostalgic. But if you really listen to that music and witness its subject, it's often about austerity Britain on the move. There's a lot of planes, boats and trains in this music. It's no accident that you have sailing by. It's no accident that you have the kind of music where you feel modernity pushing this rather traditional island people forward into the future. A lot of this music ended up being used on those public information films about how we were going to live now that we'd won the war. We're in a post-ration book world, and we were really going to get ourselves together now and move into the future. So, I mean, so much so that Ron Goodwin, one of the great British light music composers, wrote such good music for planes that people would say, if there was a war movie involving planes, get Ron Goodwin immediately. You know, they all had their area, and it was a kind of modernity they were dealing in, not just the old-fashioned, the dead world.
You asked me earlier how to define light music, and I wish I'd thought of this then. I mean, to an extent, light music is classical music for the masses, and that's why there's a lot of snobbery about it, because some people who like classical music say, actually, I don't want the masses to become involved. I don't want them to share this with me, because they won't understand it in the way that I do. And I mean, that's a very unfortunate idea. But classical music was a way, in a society that was being slowly more educated and slowly more civilized, to bring people nearer to classical music, to use a dreadful word, to make it more accessible.
We've asked you both to pick a favorite piece that you can unpack and describe for us. What have you chosen, Simon?
I've chosen The Horse Guards Whitehall by Haydn Wood from his suite London Landmarks.
Let's hear it. So what does that conjure for you, Simon?
Well, it's Down Your Way. That was every Sunday evening at 5 o'clock, that piece of music came on the home service. Many people here will remember Down Your Way. It was a programme that went out into villages and towns around Britain and spoke to the people there. And it, to me, sums up communities, people in Britain, all in it together, all in the common purpose of getting on and being British, if you like. And that piece of music, I think, went out every Sunday for about 30 years.
Is it possible to disentangle those feelings about it that you have? You know, its sense of being, you know, rather like Proust's Madeleine in some way, and say something about its musical qualities, or is that absolutely impossible?
No, it's not impossible. Haydn Wood, who wrote it, was an alumnus of his college, and he was a composition pupil of Sir Charles Villiers Stanford. So he was no mean composer and no mean intellect. And he was one of the great, if you like, pop musicians of his day. He wrote in 1916 Roses of Picardy, which is one of the most famous songs of the 20th century. And he wrote a piece of music there which is in many ways reminiscent of Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance marches. It has a very noble trio section that comes on just after the bit that we heard. And he, I think, had an implicit understanding of his audience, of people who, in those days, this is in the 1930s, had an idea of what British music should sound like, and he wrote it for them.
Andrew, your choice was also used as a radio signature tune. Tell us about that.
It was, yes. I spent a lot of my childhood learning how to deepen my frown by listening to classical music, but this did the opposite, and it's Vivian Ellis's Coronation Scot.
Andrew, this is music that makes me want to say, by Timothy, what's that ticking noise, Steve?
Absolutely. There's suddenly a whole world of Enid Blyton and Joyce Grenfell, a whole sort of incredibly scented world of Britishness comes out of that. You can practically see the train cutting its way through the fields towards Taunton from Paddington at a certain time in the evening on a Friday night.
But it's also the perfect theme tune of Paul Temple, isn't it? So it's associated with middle-class girls on morphine, isn't it? And mysterious murders, too.
That's a whole other subject. I don't know if we'll get the time for that this evening, the girls on morphine. But yes, you're quite right. You know, sometimes I wonder about light music, whether it falls into disfavor because the tunes have just become almost too popular. People recognize them almost too much. But I think it's almost worth pushing that aside and remembering what the value of the music is in itself. And Coronation Scott, for me, just has such an exuberant, incredibly intelligent, colorful sense of what it is to live in this country with this weather and these values.
I want to throw this out to the audience now, because I'm curious what your relationship with this music is and what it stirs in you. You know, maybe your feelings about it are ambivalent or nostalgic or... Yes, sir.
Yes, it all brings back wonderful memories of a happy era. And I can remember as a small boy being woken up in the morning to what was then the light programme. And this music was played with an intermittent time check. I just wonder if the panel can recall when that ceased to happen and you know, the light program gradually got, well, I'd call it dumbed down, really, if I compare it with what was played at that time. But there was, I can't remember what it was called. It was an early morning program of the type of music we'd been listening to, and periodically you would have the time check.
Well, I think that was when Radio 2 was invented, which would be 1967.
Yeah. And in a broader sense, what you witnessed, really, from the birth of rock and roll on, really, so you're really talking 56, 57, is a downscaling of the centrality of this music in British life. You know, it just petered away, and, you know, the figures speak for themselves. The BBC, under whose auspices we're here enjoying this music and speaking tonight, at one time had 8 light music orchestras. It's now got 1.
My first acquaintance with the Dvorak Slavonic Dances was hearing them on their early morning programmes. It wasn't all entirely very light music, but it was, you know, certainly a wonderful programme.
Yeah. I was fortunate to grow up in South Africa with a piano stool full of English music my dad used to play. In fact, I found some pieces recently that he actually composed when he was in South Africa with the RAF and sent back to England. But what I think about that is actually it made me feel very English. And going to see British films every Saturday evening and laughing at Carry On films and all that sort of thing, that made me really want to go to England. That's why I'm in London, actually, because I really was obsessed about England. And I think we mustn't forget the BBC World Service. That was really, really important in my life, listening to lots of those tunes were played on the World Service.
So what did it conjure for you then, sitting there in South
it's
Africa?
Just being
what
British.
Was that quality of Britishness?
It's exactly what you said. It's that British feeling of well-being. This is going to be a really good place to live. And when I arrived in 1973, it was. I'm not so sure it's like that now, but I still like being here.
Okay, well, I'm curious about why the idea of lightness was so important in this period. Is this a kind of a post-war idea, Simon, that the blackout is over, so all things light become something to focus on?
Well, the blackout's over, of course, but life is grim until really the early 1950s. Rationing is there until 1953. You've got in 1947 the coldest winter in living memory when fuel is still rationed. And you can't get petrol. You know, these are hard times, and people are... there is more or less full employment, but people don't have high standards of living. And one of the great functions of the BBC in those days was to cheer people up. And light music, as I said, the BBC was the great patron of light music in this country, not just for pillaging it for theme tunes for its programmes, but also, as Andrew said, having 8 orchestras that would go around playing it. It was performing this public service of keeping morale going at a time when we'd won the war, but many people thought we were losing the peace. And I think that is really quite important and quite central. That's why lightness mattered.
Does it also fit with a broader kind of cultural idea about lightness, Andrew? Somehow that this is the era in which, you know, refinement was seen as a great quality, you know, in food, in things that people consuming. You know, this is the era where things with the bits taken out are really kind of glamorous and sexy.
Yes, I think there is that. You know, there's a certain sense in which people are ready for a sort of easy tasting menu. After the sort of austerity and the difficulty in the dark times. But also, I think we're moving slowly through the 50s towards an explosion in popular culture. This is part of popular culture and its movement into the center of our lives, that suddenly you don't simply measure your identity and your musical tastes against very high culture and high seriousness, but you can also suddenly live a life in which the stuff you enjoy to dance around to, the stuff that accompanies adverts and that sort of jingles through your life, can also have a validity, if you like, of its own. And this is even before pop music made claims, as it does now, for all sorts of new seriousness. This music suddenly wanted to appeal to a sense of democracy in us that was quite new. The authority was being questioned.
What killed light music, Simon?
Well, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the counterculture of the 60s, and the fact that it became associated with people in floral print dresses and trilbies. That's what killed it.
I wonder whether, though, those more, what we might think of as more countercultural forms of music are reabsorbing the influence of light music. I want you to listen now to a track called Slip Into Something More Comfortable by Kenobi. Now, to my ear, Andrew, the ghosts of Sailing By haunt this music.
Definitely. I completely love that. In fact, I want that to be played at my funeral. No, certainly slipping into something more comfortable. I love that. And I think, it pushes the envelope. It really does. You know, it's soporific. You could slightly tune out of the world to that music. And I know that people would immediately say, well, that's not what classical music is for. It's to tune you back in and tune you into yourself and tradition. Of course, and there are aspects of light music that does that. But this is an example of the kind which almost sort of zaps you with its sort of liquid easiness. There was a piece of music that was never more than 30 seconds long, which used to accompany the advertising jingle at the cinema for Pearl and Dean. It went fa 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 fa. And whenever ever I hear that, no matter how banal it might be and how simplistic, it is that Proustian Madeleine. It takes me right back to the Regal Cinema in Saltcoats in Ayrshire in 1972, waiting for the Revenge of the Killer Bees to appear. You know, it's just magical music.
Okay, well, light music is pleasantly short, so I'm going to stop now while we're still enjoying ourselves. So don't get too excited, but it'd be awfully nice if you'd show your appreciation for my guests, Simon Heffer and Andrew O'Hagan.
Matthew Sweet presented Proms Plus, which took place at the Royal College of Music earlier today. Some lovely memories there. And, of course, light music at the BBC. Well, Friday Night is Music Night has been presenting that every Friday for, well, more than 60 years now. Quite a long time, Petrock.
Yeah, and you go back to day one, don't you?
I could have been listening, but only just. Wasn't quite old enough for that then.
And if you're going to gratuitously plug your Radio 2 show on Radio 3, I should also say I play lots of light music on my breakfast show every morning from 6:30 to 9 over on Radio 3.
I was going to ask which station that might be on, but you've told us. Petrock Trelawney and Ken Bruce here at the Royal Albert Hall. The Prommers are making their traditional thank you for their donations here.
Yeah, up to £23,000 they've raised for musical charities so far, which is fantastic. Music with a royal connection in our light music prom tonight here on Radio 2 and on Radio 3. In a moment, the Three Elizabeths by the so-called King of Light Music, Eric Coates, a three-movement work celebrating Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother, and our present monarch. But first of all, William Walton, his march Crown Imperial, first performed at the coronation of George VI in 1937.
And you may have heard it more recently at the end of the wedding ceremony of Prince William and Catherine Middleton, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, in 2011. It's certainly one of William Walton's most popular pieces on the concert hall, which is perhaps just as well, because there aren't that many coronations or royal weddings these days. You can't rely on them for income, really, can you? If you're a composer, no, not really. It's very much like it's in the tradition, at any rate, of the Elgar Pomp and Circumstance March, the most famous of which appears, of course, at the last night of the proms every year. It's a great big, brilliant fanfare-like opening, and again, a closing like that, and one of those huge, stately tunes right in the middle of it.
Well, silence falling on the Royal Albert Hall, the BBC Concert Orchestra in place on the stage, and behind the bust of Sir Henry Wood, Roderick Elms sits at the mighty Royal Albert Hall organ, a fine instrument of which we'll be hearing much in part two of this concert. Barry Wordsworth bows from the rostrum, opens part two of our prom with Walton's Crown Imperial.
magnificently stirring sound of Walton's Crown Imperial, played here at the Proms by the BBC Concert Orchestra and Barry Wordsworth, with a magnificent organ of the Royal Albert Hall, which you don't just hear in the Royal Albert Hall, but you feel them in the fibre of your being.
The vibrations are amazing, aren't they? Eric Coates next, his Three Elizabeths Suite. Elizabeth Tudor in the first movement, Springtime in Angus in the second, a celebration of the Queen Mother, and then to end another march, Youth of Britain, representing the then Princess Elizabeth as she was our current Queen. The idea suggested to Coates by a vicar from Barnes. Barry Wordsworth, conductor laureate of the BBC Concert Orchestra, leading the Free Elizabeth Suite for Orchestra by Eric Coates. Elizabeth Tudor, the first movement, Springtime in Angus, portrait of the then Queen, later became Queen Mother, and the last movement, Youth of Britain. Work written during the Second World War. Great optimism in that depiction of Princess Elizabeth. Uses a signature tune for something or other, that wasn't it, the last movement?
Yeah, there are times when age has its advantages. Yes, the Forsyte Saga in 1967. That's what it was used, the last drama the BBC did in black and white. And they were very sorry it was in black and white as well. Back to Malcolm Arnold now for his four English dances. The first set of those, he wrote two sets of four, as well, of course, as sets of Scottish and Cornish dances.
Should be doing the Cornish ones tonight, shouldn't they?
Well, they should be doing the Scottish ones, really. They are in the style of country dances, country folk tunes, rather than real ones. Hence, the movements don't actually have titles, only tempo directions. The first one is called Andantino, which translates to me as sweetly melancholic. The second movement is vivace, that's lively. The third one is mournful, mesto. It starts with a bassoon, which unfortunately is entirely right for the bassoon. It is traditionally a mournful instrument, we must say.
But with integrity.
Well, indeed. And the fourth movement, allegro risoluto, is rousing and begins with a rather forceful performance by the French horns.
Well, there's a big Arnold family presence here tonight, at least half a dozen members of the Arnold family. Piers Burton Page, his biographer, is here as well. Harry Wordsworth returns to conduct set one of Arnold's English Dances. BBC Concert Orchestra here at the Proms, live on Radio 2 and Radio 3.
The BBC Concert Orchestra, Barry Wordsworth with Malcolm Arnold's Four English Dances, set one. And loud applause for bassoonist Margaret Pollock and flautist Ileana Ruhrmann.
Brass section sounding fantastic, aren't they?
Playing beautifully this evening, as of course they often do.
Well, we finish this great celebration of light music with a splendid melody of BBC Radio signature tunes of yesteryear, woven together by that master arranger and composer Gordon Langford, longtime collaborator with the BBC Concert Orchestra, pianist on many a Friday night, his music night over the years. Notepads ready, see how many you can recognise.
Thank you.
Barry Wordsworth and the BBC Concert Orchestra. Roderick Elms being Sandy McPherson doing that at the organ. With Gordon Langford's Say It With Music. Now, Petrock, we need to go through what the titles were in that. I'll begin with Say It With Music, which was the easy one. That's Jack Payne's programme. Then, of course, Barwick Green, The Archers.
Spice of Life, Music Hall, Hancock's Half Hour, of course, immediately recognisable. And Monday Night at 8.
The Dales, Mrs. Dale's Diary as it was before that. The Parade of the Tin Soldiers was the theme to Toy Town. The Navy Lark, a lot of people got that. Tuesday Serenade, Valse Serenade, the title of that. And then, of course,
By the Sleepy Lagoon, Cue the Seagulls, Desert Island Discs, Roses from the South, Grand Hotel, Calling All Workers, that's an easy one, Music While You Work. Take it from here, Here's to the Next Time, which Henry Hall had as his theme tune.
Much Binding in the Marsh followed that, It's That Man Again, Itmar, Keep Smiling, from Reginald Fort, then the Alpenruhr Waltz, Sandy McPherson's famous piece.
With A Song in My Heart, two-way family favourites, of course.
And I'm not sure, I didn't hear Wagoners Walk in PM, but I'm told they were in there. But I've heard this piece so often and never recognised all of them in it.
21 tunes.
Beautifully arranged all by together. Gordon Langford. Barry Wordsworth coming back on to further great applause from our audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. And the orchestra stand to receive their acknowledgement. There's another prom taking place later this evening. At 10.15 on Radio 3, you'll be able to hear it, featuring music by, believe it or not, Frank Zappa. And this features a car chase, a love-in, a coughing mountain, a choir of stenographers, and a swine pig called Gregory. It's Frank Zappa's The Adventures of Gregory Peccary, that plus a piece by Nancaro, and Philip Glass's Symphony No. 10, played by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin tonight, 10.15 on Radio 3.
Yes, we get very, very late night on Radio 3. Radio 3, the home of the proms, at least one concert every night. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, stalwarts of the season, give tomorrow night's concert. I'll be back here to introduce a lovely concert on Saturday, which includes Beethoven 5 and the Blue Danube Waltz. It all happens at Radio 3. Full details at bbc.co.uk/proms. Barry Wordsworth is back on stage. Ken, I'm afraid for us, the party is over. What fun we've had.
It's been a terrific evening. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And working with you has been almost a pleasure.
We must do this again next year.
Yes, indeed we must. But for tonight, we have to go. I'm going to be playing some more music and looking forward to some other programmes on Radio 2 in a moment.
I'm going to hand you back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House. From Ken and from me, good night.
Good night.
Ken Bruce and Petrock Trelawney at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight, and for Radio 2, a simultaneous broadcast on two BBC networks. And if you came in some way into that concert and you'd like to hear it again, then you can do so tomorrow afternoon on Radio 3 when it forms our Proms Repeat programme during afternoon on 3. That's all from 2 o'clock tomorrow. Or if you prefer, you can hear it online, where you'll find all of the proms sitting there for 7 days after their initial broadcast, and plenty more besides as well. bbc.co.uk/radio3. Well, as Ken said, we'll be back at the proms here on Radio 3 in 45 minutes' time, or actually, no, an hour from now, for a late-night rendezvous with a brand-new symphony by Philip Glass and music for player piano by Conlan, Nancaro and others, all from a 10:15 this evening. And Petrock briefly mentioned there that Oliver Nussum will be conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night in a programme of 20th century music by Hans-Werner Henze, amongst others his Barcarolla, composed in 1979. And music by Stravinsky, and to end, Michael Tippett's Second Symphony. So that's our prom tomorrow night, live here on BBC Radio 3 at 7:30. Well, we have a little time to go before our next programme tonight, which takes a look at negative thinking. Now, you might imagine that it's a bit counterproductive, when in fact, according to the poet and the novelist Patrick McGuinness, it's actually vital to the life of the mind and to the progress of thought. He calls his investigation into the subject Think Negative, and you can hear it at 9:30 tonight here on Radio 3. In the meantime, I have music from Mexico. In fact, a piece dubbed Mexico's second national anthem. It's by Arturo Márquez, who shot to fame with this piece just 20 years ago when he composed it. And this is the orchestra that had a great deal to do with its success, I would wager. Something of a theme tune for them, the Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra of Venezuela, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. Dance on number 2 by Marquez. The Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra of Venezuela was conducted there by Gustavo Dudamel. Sadly, not at the proms this year with all their swaying and their juggling of trumpets. It's just coming up to 9:30 now. Ian Skelly here to guide you through our programmes tonight on Radio 3. The music of Philip Glass will feature in our late prom in 45 minutes' time. It's the UK premiere of his 10th symphony tonight. And also that curious race through the adventures of Gregory Peccary by Frank Zappa, always worth a listen to there. There's also a study for Play a Piano by Nan Caro in the programme. The Aurora Orchestra gives the prom, and their conductor, Nicholas Colon, is there at 10:15 tonight. And then at 11 o'clock, we'll be joining Fiona Talkington for the next edition of Late Junction this week. She's been charting many of the highlights that featured at this year's WOMAD Festival amid the rainstorms last weekend. We broadcast plenty of concerts live from the WOMAD Festival, but Fiona was there with her microphone and indeed Radio 3's to record plenty more. And you can hear the results at 9:45, in fact, tonight after our late prom. But it's now 9:30 and time to think negative. The novelist, poet and professor of French literature at Oxford University, Patrick McGuinness, considers the vital importance of negation, naysaying and creative contrariness, all to the progress of thought and the life of the mind.
The saints, the hermits, the intellectuals, the ones that shaped history, are the people who said no. This refusal should not be small or sensible, but large and total.
Those are among the last recorded words of the poet and filmmaker Pier Paolo Pasolini, taken from an interview on the day he was mysteriously murdered and found in a field outside Rome in 1975. Those lines have always haunted me. They make me think of history's great refusals, resistances, rebellions, whether it's obstructing the tanks in Prague or Tiananmen Square, protesting not in my name or sitting down to occupy Wall Street.
And where we are met with cynicism and doubt and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can.
President Obama's yes, we can rhetoric would not be possible if Rosa Parks hadn't said no, refusing to move her seat on a bus 50 years before. It's important to remember that much of what we feel to be positive in politics begins with a negative, with resistance and refusal of a status quo. With Pasolini's words in mind, I like to think back to another field outside Rome, centuries before.
Could we have won Spartacus? Could we ever have won?
And just by fighting them, we won something. When just one man says, no, I won't, Rome begins to fear. And we were tens of thousands who said no. That was the wonder of it.
Stanley Kubrick's version of Spartacus. Negative thinking can be a stirring force for change, even if it ends in defeat, as it did classically for Spartacus. Negativity gets a pretty bad press these days, but where has positive thinking got us? Whether it's the unfounded economic optimism that persuaded us nothing would go wrong and took us into the biggest economic crisis for 80 years, or a blind belief in progress that persuaded us that the money, the oil, the rainforests would never run out, whether it's the reams of can-do self-help books colonizing our bookshops or the frenetic boosterism of Olympic mania, enforced positivity remains the order of the day. Scurrilous but plausible rumors spread through the web a while back that even that iconic grumpy philosopher Eeyore would be exiled from the forthcoming Disney reboot of Winnie the Pooh. Market research groups, those tyrants of consensus, suggested that he was hopelessly off message, too much of a downer for today's children. Mercifully, this proved untrue. Eeyore does feature in the 2011 version where, tellingly, he's prevailed upon by the bumptious Tigger to get with the upbeat program to be Tigger 2.
We just need to get you Tiggerized.
My day job is teaching students, optimistic people as a whole, part of a new generation especially nervous about negative energy, ever scornful of haters. But what I teach them in my literature classes is Beckett, Baudelaire, Céline, Mallarmé, art and literature that comes from loss and pain, from anger, questioning and refusal.
The secret of survival is a defective imagination. The inability of mortals to imagine things as they truly are is what allows them to live. Since one momentary, unresisted glimpse of the world's totality of suffering would annihilate them on the spot, like a whiff of the most lethal sewer gas. We have stronger stomachs, stouter lungs. We see it all in all its awfulness at every moment and are not daunted. That is the difference. That is what makes us divine.
John Banville, reading from his wonderful novel, The Infinities. The speaker there is a god, Hermes. But his disenchanted perspective is surely also a writer's, or a reader's. For Renard, Banville implies, we must confront the awful totality of the human condition, negatives and all. Banville is finely attuned to those writers, like his beloved Samuel Beckett, who unflinchingly, but above all wittily, dissect the dark side. Nothing is funnier than unhappiness, says Beckett's Nell in Endgame. So can we talk about a literary counter-tradition of the negative?
Oh yes, I think so. I mean, you don't have to look back terribly far to see the two streams beginning. Let's say if you take Goethe and Schiller on one side and Heinrich von Kleist on the other, Kleist is very much working, I think, in the negative tradition. And that goes on through Kafka, on to Bernhardt, to Beckett, to Porcelain. There is an identifiable stream there.
And what's interesting about this tradition is that it really questions language and representation too, doesn't it? It's not interested in describing the world as it is or the status quo. It's actually more interested in what isn't there and what can't be represented.
Yes, the ones who have what one might call a negative aesthetic are trying to get beyond mere appearance to essentials. Certainly Beckett did that. You know, he threw out as much of the lumber of 19th century literature as he could. He kept throwing out. But of course, he couldn't get to a point where there was nothing left. Flaubert, Joyce, they wanted to write novels that would be pure style. They would not be about anything. They wouldn't have any content. But of course, it's not possible because language, as I've written somewhere, is a vulgar medium. Hmm. And it's in touch with reality. It's in touch with actuality at every point. Therefore, you can't rid it of content. There would be nothing left except noise.
Yes, there is that tradition, isn't there, of writing a book about nothing, a book that abolishes the world as it describes it, and that dream of pure style, as you say, is never really possible. But Beckett does talk about how he's no longer capable of writing about anything, and I suppose it's that about, isn't it, that's the stumbling block for anyone who wants to perfect and refine their negative tradition of writing.
Yes, but he says in Worstwood Ho, which is probably the closest he came to actually putting his negative aesthetics into a single work, you know, at the start he says on, say on, said be on, somehow on, to know how on, said know how on. And after, you know, nearly 50 pages of negativities, he comes to the end and he says, best, worst, farther, know how less, know how worse, know how not, know how on, said know how on. Now, I take said know-how-on to be a way forward, because if you could say it, you make a double negative, so you can go on. And I think this, you know, Beckett always, at the end, holds out a hand, a helping hand to himself to move forward. In that letter to Axel Kahn, which he wrote in 1937, and he declares, my language appears to me like a veil which one has to tear apart in order to get at those things or the nothingness lying behind it. So he's always trying to express, he's trying to express in a negative way, but he's compelled to express, as he says famously in Beloit, not to want to say, not to know what you want to say, not to be able to say what you think you want to say, and never to stop saying, or hardly ever. That is the thing to keep in mind, even in the heat of a composition. It's a wonderfully funny piece, yes. But it's also, I think, a very succinct statement of his aesthetic.
Yes, and that's just reminded me how incredibly and richly funny Beckett is, because whatever the philosophical underpinnings of his negative aesthetic, it produces over and over a real, not joyful, but exuberant comedy. I was thinking of that letter where Beckett says, "I feel myself moving away from ideas of poverty and bareness." And then he adds, "They are still superlatives."
Yes, this is wonderful. I mean, Beckett was so funny, so funny. He couldn't not be funny.
But in terms of this tradition, it's not to everyone's cup of tea. And there's a hilarious bit in Martin Amis's memoir when he's having an argument with Salman Rushdie about Samuel Beckett.
Novelist and essayist Jeff Dyer.
Rushdie loves Beckett, and they're in a bar or a restaurant, and Amis comes up with these great parodies of Beckett. He says, "All you need is maximum ugliness and a lot of negatives. Nor it, the nothing never is. Neither nowhere, the nothing is not. Non-nothing, the never." And then, you know, they're rather drunk, and Amis keeps coming up with this stuff. By this stage, Salman looked like a falcon staring through a Venetian blind, and Amis keeps going, "No, neither, nor never, none, not no." And it culminates with Rushdie, who can't take it anymore, saying, "Do you want to come outside?"
Dyer revels in the comedy of the negative, but also the way it allows us to be critical of ourselves, too. A sharp, self-directed critique. He enjoys the repetitions and rants of the likes of Thomas Bernhardt, the icy, barbed aphorisms of ultra-gloomy philosophers like Emil Cioran.
It seems to me a lot of the European writers I like do have a somewhat negative side to them. I don't know when it starts. I'm not a professional philosopher, but I reckon you could do a lot worse than going back to Nietzsche when he says, "Ah, suicide. The thought of it has got me through many a bad night." That sort of turning things to your advantage like that. And what I'm struck by is the way that a lot of these ostensibly negative writers, Cioran, Thomas Bernhardt, bits of Pessoa, they're screamingly funny. And it seems to me that's where the redemptive side of things comes in. In fact, I mean, we don't even have to read a bit of Cioran. We just mention the title of one of his great books, The Trouble with Being Born. I mean,
yes.
It says it all. You know, there's a bit where he talks of his physical need of dishonour. How I should have liked to be the executioner's son. And he's incredibly dark, Cioran, but there are a series of kind of anti-Christmas cracker aphorisms. Susan Sontag, of course, has written a very, very serious essay on Cioran, and it seems to me in some way she doesn't get him at all, because he's doing it partly just for the fun of it.
There's a pure pleasure in negativity too, isn't there, which stops it from being sterile. Mm. The tradition that you're referring to is really negative energy that is being invested.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And if we think of one of the great naysayers, Thomas Bernhardt, you know, the Austrian, what we get there is this unbelievable, it's this extravagant ranting and complaining, and he's absolutely inexhaustible. And there's a really lovely bit in his last book, the perfectly titled Extinction, where he says something like, "All art is about exaggeration." Then, of course, in his great Bernhardian way, he says, "And I am myself the greatest exaggerator that there's ever been." And he says that the art of exaggeration is the art of tiding oneself over existence, of sort of getting through life. And what I love about that is that, well, first of all, there's the obvious gag of the exaggeration. But here is, we think of exaggeration as being a rather sort of positive thing. And Bernhardt has got this huge excess of energy when it comes to complaining. He never gets tired of lamenting his lot. It keeps him going, just as the thought of suicide kept Nietzsche going in rather briefer style.
He avoids the sun. There's nothing he shuns more than the sun. "I hate the sun. You know that I hate the sun more than anything in the world," he says. What he likes best are foggy days. On foggy days, he leaves the house very early in the morning, actually takes a walk, which he does not normally do, for basically he hates walking. "I hate walking," he says. "It seems so pointless to me. I walk, and while I'm walking, I keep thinking how I hate walking. I have no other thoughts at the time. I cannot understand that there are people who are able to think while walking, to think of something other than that walking is pointless and useless," he says. "I prefer to walk up and down in my room. It is then that I have my best ideas. I can stand by the window for hours, looking down into the street. I look down into the street and observe the people, and ask myself, who are these people, and what is moving them down there in the street? I've never been attracted more intensively by anything than by human beings, and at the same time, never more thoroughly repelled by anything than by human beings. I loathe people, but they are simultaneously the sole purpose of my life."
For a long time, I felt the negative not just as an idea or a state of mind, but in terms of places and spaces. My first novel, The Last 100 Days, drew on my experience as a teenager living in Romania at the end of the Ceausescu regime. Under Ceausescu, an area of Bucharest the size of Venice was demolished. Places you knew and loved would be bulldozed at such short notice you'd walk out of your house one day and see a gap like a vast grave where a church or a house had stood. I thought of this as the negative city. It had the relationship with the new city of a negative to its photograph. The novel I'm working on now takes me to another negative space. It takes me to Bruges. It's hard to think negatively about a city as beautiful as Bruges, with its perfectly preserved buildings, its horse-drawn carts for tourists, and its legendary carillon chiming in the air. But Bruges played an important role in late 19th century art and literature. It was the city of death, the city of darkness, of absence, and stilled time.
The beauty of sorrow is superior to the beauty of life. It is the beauty of Bruges, great glory that has gone. One last fixed smile. Everything around us has withdrawn within itself. The waters are still, the houses closed, the bells whisper in the mist. That is the secret of its charm. Why want it to become like all the rest? It is unique. Walking through Bruges is like walking through memories.
The reason for Bruges' notoriety was largely down to one of the most sensational novels of the 1890s, Bruges la Morte, Bruges the Dead, published in 1892 by the Belgian poet and novelist Georges Rodenbach. Like most symbolist novels, it used place as an objective correlative, a way of projecting outwards the inner states of mind and soul of the human characters. The hero of the book, the widower Hugues Vianne, chooses the city to mourn his dead wife, and uses the innate antiquarian melancholy of Bruges to revel in his grief. Rodenbach's influence reached its height in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when his book inspired a cult of dead, or negative, cities. Tourists, most of them from Paris and other major fast-moving capitals, flocked to Bruges and to Flanders with Rodenbach's novel as their Baedeker. Rodenbach had created an anti-grand tour. In a series of essays called The Death Throes of Towns, he made a negative atlas that included Ghent, Oudenaarde, Saint-Malo, but Bruges was the centerpiece.
These keys of Bruges, how in my pensive youth I followed, confessed, loved them. With secret places I alone knew about and consoled, houses whose dead windows watched me. And in the prison of those keys of stone, the stagnant water of the canals, where no more ships or small craft pass, where nothing is reflected other than the stillness of the gables, whose crow steps traced on the waters seem like stairways of crepe leading to the very bottom. And as if to wash the corpse of the lifeless waters, there is the eternal weeping, the streaming and dripping of gutters, the drains and sporadic springs, the overflow from the roofs, the seepage from the tunnels of the bridges, like a great euphony of sobbing and inconsolable tears.
This is the canal side where the docks used to be. What we see along here are these beautiful red brick warehouses. And this is where the merchants would have unloaded their textiles. In the late 15th century, Bruges went from being the busiest and most vibrant port in Europe to one of the great symbolic abandoned cities. What Rodenbach did was take that 19th century obsession with the dying city, with the city of decline and decadence and decrepitude, he turned it into the ultimate late 19th century image of poetic negativity. How did Bruges go from being one of the great cities of Europe to becoming this dead city, this bypassed backwater relic city?
I think of a different aspect.
Belgian poet, novelist and cultural historian Stefan Hertmans.
In the first place, of course, a geographical one, the silting up of the estuary, which gave Bruges an entrance to the sea, gradually disappeared. So Bruges could not compete anymore with greater ports coming up like Amsterdam and Antwerp. This is one of the first things. At the same time, its prestige grew even after it was declining. That's very funny. The city was economically declining, but the prestige grew by all of the great artworks.
That paradox that in its decline it also produced great art, I suppose. Part of that paradox is Rodenbach's novel Bruges la Morte, which became so popular that it caused thousands of tourists to come from places like France and especially Paris to come and see what a dead, declined city looked like.
Exactly. He came here at the point when also Byron and Ruskin went to Venice to see what the greatness of the past had become. And the falling down, the disintegration of the architecture went together, of course, with a fascination for the water, cities at the waterside. And what remained of this great, huge Bruges was only the water as a sort of artery in the city. But the water had become a dark mirror. It had become something dead. But in the dead, the living was reflected again. So all of this made the charm of a sort of exotic, sort of sepulchre of a great Flemish European culture. Bruges revived by the people who came to see how dead it was. You revive it by a parallel economy.
What strikes me about Bruges is that Bruges is always contemplating itself and it's looking at its reflection. But it's also perhaps the opposite or the antidote to Paris, the great city of fast-moving life and fast-moving water. And I suppose that's why so many Parisian literati loved the image of Bruges that Rodenbach gave them, because he gave them an opposite city to Paris.
Absolutely. I guess this has to do with the fact